Hello, I'm Rupert Soskin.
And I'm Michael Bott. Welcome to another Prehistory Guys interview, introducing you to people who are out there working hard to bring archaeology and prehistory to a wider audience.
Yes, and today we're talking with Dr. Tess Macklin, archaeologist and researcher working with museum replica maker Roland Williamson. She has a particular fascination for Iron Age talks, running a website with Roland called The Big Book of Talks. And she's membership secretary to the Prehistory Society as well, and wait for it, a maker of replica artifacts in chocolate.
Yeah, I don't think we should make it quite the dominant theme. It would be easy to do so, have to say. But have you seen any of Tess's chocolate artifacts?
They're completely insane. You would never know they weren't the genuine article. I mean, everything from flint arrowheads to copper axes and all edible. I can't imagine bringing myself to eat one, though.
No, agreed. Mind you, they are made of chocolate. Moving on. Tess has been membership secretary for the Prehistory Society for 25 years and is constantly active in bringing prehistory into the public domain.
Yeah, notably, I have to say, as a leader in the Young Archaeologists Club, and personally, I can't think of anything more valuable than inspiring children in any field.
How very true. She really is a powerhouse behind the scenes.
She is. Should we get her on then?
I think we better had. So welcome, Tess. Welcome to the Prehistory Guys podcast. Great to have you with us.
It is. It's a treat to have you with us.
And it's fun to be here.
Yeah, well, you wait. Do you know what? The first question we always ask absolutely everybody, because people do love to know, what was it that got you started in archaeology in the first place?
What got me started in archaeology? Well, I think fossils and playing around in the garden, like so many of us. And then I was doing various things with the Young Archaeologist Club, went on my first dig when I was 12, sliced my finger to the bone, which didn't put me off, came back again, and then started digging in Sussex from that point on. And I'm however many years old now, and I've been doing it ever since. So, yeah.
Yeah. So it was fossils that actually kicked you off then, rather than...
Well, that was kind of... Yeah, I grew up in Sussex. I grew up in Sussex, so chalk. Yeah. There's lots of fossils in chalk. And then you gradually move on. I think so many people do. You start off with that and then get into archaeology.
I remember being convinced I was going to find a brontosaurus in the garden if I dug down.
These were kind of sea urchins and things like that. They weren't quite as big as a brontosaurus, but yeah.
Oh, you probably actually got a result then, yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic. So, because you mentioned the Young Archaeologists Club there, so
yes.
So you actually kicked off with the Young Archaeologists Club then,
didn't you? I did. I was never a member of a club, but I used to get their newsletter from somewhere, and that was where I found the first dig that I went on. After a lovely letter to Peter Druitt, bless him, who's gone now. But yes, he was brilliant. And he said, oh, yes, get out and dig and do stuff. And there's the Sussex Field Archaeology Unit, as was then, which is now a commercial unit. And I went digging with them and never looked back, and then worked for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good way to get into archaeology.
Yeah.
Was there a standout moment that turned your head, that had you say to yourself, I'm going to do this forever and a day?
I don't know. I don't think I ever doubted that I wasn't going to. I love being outdoors. I'm not a 9-to-5 office person, so it's suited in so many different ways. You get to be with lots of people of your own age, you get to go out and get muddy, you know, you have fun. It's good. And then you get to find great archaeology as well. I mean, I was always interested in history anyway, so it just kind of fell into all of it, I think.
Yeah, and what was your academic pathway then?
I did a degree at UCL, a general archaeology degree, which was a lot of field work. Then ended up working as a field archaeologist for a few years, then ended up doing medieval pottery because they needed someone to look at some medieval pottery, then got into prehistoric pottery, then bizarrely ended up working out in the Caribbean. looking
as you
at
do.
Yeah.
Sorry to say.
Well, there is a kind of pottery link there somewhere, but so yeah, I ended up doing a PhD on 17th century fortifications in the Caribbean. Then had my daughter, took time off to look after her, and then came back in again a few years ago. I mean, I've had the Prehistoric Society membership secretary job now for 25 years, so that's kind of seen me through all the different things I've done. But yes, now I'm back in the Iron Age again looking at gold, which is not something most archaeologists get to do. It's
I know.
Isn't that the truth?
And we'll have a have a great conversation about gold later on. but perfectly, because the next question I was going to ask you was about the Prehistoric Society in the last 25 years that you've been with them. Have you been membership secretary all that time?
I have.
My goodness gracious me.
Ever since I was a very young 20-something and terrified sitting in council rooms with all of the names off my bookshelf sitting before me. So, but yes, it's great. It's great. It's a fantastic organisation.
How did that happen for you?
A friend said somebody's just left the job and they're looking for someone. And I happened to be in London at the time. So, yes, I was interviewed and got it. And I've been doing it ever since. So
right place, right time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think so much of archaeology is about that. It's about networking and getting yourself known and talking to the people, you know. So
for those that don't know, tell us about the Prehistoric Society, because we've got a lot of new folks here.
Absolutely. No, it's a great organisation. I mean, we go back. I think 1908 it started out as the Prehistoric Society of East Anglia and then became the Prehistoric Society in 1935. We're basically a learned society, so one of the four period societies. So you've got the Roman Society, Medieval Archaeology, Post-Med Arch, and us. And yeah, we produce a journal, we produce newsletters, we operate worldwide. We're the kind of leading organisation for prehistory, really. So we've umbrella for a lot of other different things.
What's the membership?
And member, sorry,
that was asking the same question. Yeah, that's it. So what sort of size membership is the society now?
Well, we've got about 1,300 individuals, but the journal, the Proceedings of the Prehistoric Society, goes out to just about every academic university in the world.
Go on, Mike.
And they've all got online access. So, yeah.
It's worth the membership for that alone.
Hundreds of thousands, I would think, have access to us.
It's fantastic what you do, actually.
Yeah, it is. It's a really good organisation. Really good.
Although it has to be said that your activity within the society, okay, so you're the membership secretary, but you're very active in kind of putting things out in the public domain, aren't you? Or when I say public domain, even if it's within the society, I mean, particularly, you know, your Facebook presence, for example, you're keeping that pot stirred very vigorously, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, we're a charity and a company, and we very much see our role as not just towards our membership, but also towards prehistory in the wider world. And for a lot of people, a more academic output doesn't suit, but they're still interested in prehistory. Also, you've got prehistory on the national curriculum now in primary schools.
Yes, that's great. Mm.
So we've always seen a really important part of what we do as being outreach. And the easiest way of doing that nowadays is social media. So as you know, we have an incredibly active Facebook group, which now has over 16,000 members.
Yeah.
We've also got a Twitter presence. We've produced online resources for schools and homeschooling, which in the current situation has just been fantastic.
In a normal world, you also put on conferences.
We do. Conferences, lectures, events, site visits, which have all ground to a halt this year, but we'll be back next year. I don't think we've actually cancelled anything yet. Europa's being moved, which is our big annual conference.
Yeah.
We're just rerunning it next year, so fingers crossed.
And you always get the most fantastic speakers.
We do
as well.
We
do absolutely completely.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, because we are the leading organisation, many of our council members are leading prehistorians. Many of our members are leading prehistorians, and we can ask, you know, who we'd like to speak to us. So we're very lucky in that way.
So what are the let me give you an opportunity. Let us give you an opportunity to sell the Prehistoric Society.
Excellent.
You know, what the benefits of membership, all that, you know, for people having.
Well, yes. I mean, it's we are one of the cheapest national, let alone regional organisations. So
not
I
in
think,
a pejorative sense.
No, absolutely. No, just in the cash way. So I mean, £35, which is what it will cost you for a year, including postage and packing, will get you a copy of our journal, free access online to all back copies of the Proceedings of the Prehistoric Society and the Proceedings of the Prehistoric Society of East Anglia all the way back to 1908. You get three newsletters mailed out to you. You get access to so many grants. We do various grants for travel, conference grants, research grants. I'm just trying to think what else. Lots of site visits. Like I say, we've been really lucky. We went to Must Farm three times when it was open. We've been going every year to Avebury to see the excavations there. You'll also get loads of lectures in the evenings in London and across the country, conferences, day schools, you name it, we do it, and all for £35.
That is astonishing. You know, you've completely sold it to me again.
It is ridiculous value for money, it has to
it
be
is.
Said.
You know.
Shut up
it
and
is.
Take my money.
And for students, it's even better because it's only £17.50. Yeah. So, you know.
It's crazy.
It is, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, listen, moving on, because otherwise the time will just pass us by and we won't get through half the stuff that we want to talk about. Tell us about, because you do a lot of work with Ronald Williamson, don't you? The
Roland.
Did I say Roland? Oh, God. Yes.
That's okay. I'm sure he'll forgive you.
I do hope so. because he makes museum replica artifacts, doesn't
yes.
he?
And, yes.
So tell us a little bit about the work that you do alongside him.
Yeah, I mean, we've basically been working together for about 5 years. And my side of things is more the kind of academic research, whereas Rolls is more kind of how things were made. He's got the very practical knowledge and experience. And together we started looking at talks, which has been, yes, a bit of an odyssey. I started off at the beginning not knowing anything about talks. And
well, do you know
suddenly
what?
I'll
stop you right there. So that you tell people, to begin with, explain what a talk is, because so many people don't actually know. And
yeah, I mean, a talk, the name actually comes from talk as in twist. So that's where it starts out. And it used to be T-O-R-Q-U-E, as in the talk twist. But now it's become TORC, and basically they are neck rings. So in this country, you get them from about the Bronze Age, where you've got these beautiful gold neck rings of various varieties. And then the ones we look at are Iron Age, and you can have very simple ones that are a single bar or two bars twisted together, or the ones that we are more focused on, which are more like the Snettisham Great Talk, which has the twisted wires round in springs, which are then turned round more to make a rope with the terminals on the end.
I mean, to look at, you know, it's a circle with a section cut out, basically, but often with decoration to the ends.
They're like a C-shape. They're basically a C-shape. But you do also get ones that are a complete circle that have a kind of locking mechanism so you can take a section out.
Okay.
There's several from France like that.
Okay. And are they always sort of sized for the neck, or can there be smaller?
No, they're... Yeah. Mostly they're sort of neck size, but you do get bracelet size ones. But we're not even sure if some of them were worn. They may have been put on statues and things like that. Yeah, so with a lot of them, you do get wear along the areas which would have sat on the collarbone. So you've got a pretty good idea they were worn.
Okay.
Then others, what they were doing in between the times when they were worn as well. So they may have been worn sometimes and maybe put on a statue, others maybe kept, we're not entirely sure.
So what's our understanding of them from a social point of view, for example? Are they for the rich, the affluent, the elite, or are they more widely used than that?
Well, that's the question. I think it also depends on material, because you get them in bronze. There's even a lead one from very late on from Northamptonshire, but bronze, silver, gold. The quality of the workmanship tends to change according to the material used. Mm. And I think it's probably, we don't really know is the short answer, but I think there's definitely a relationship. We're seeing a relationship between higher quality craftsmanship on better quality gold, which would suggest that there is some element of status or prestige. But whether that is individual status, community status, religious status, who knows? But there is definitely a gradation. It's like now, you can have a ring that's a Ratner's ring or a Garrard's ring, you know. It doesn't make it less of a ring. But who's buying these things, who's commissioning these things, we don't know. It could be communal, it could be individual.
Well, I was fascinated to read that that some of them that have been found have, so rather than being solid and extremely expensive, they might have been hollow and even filled with wax to make them feel weighty, that sort of thing.
I mean, so that's one thing we've become very, very interested in, because there is definitely, at the period in the Iron Age when these talks start appearing, from about the 4th, 3rd century BC, there is a lack of gold in this country. And we're seeing, if you look at something like the Snettisham Great Talk, which has the huge terminals and the very thick neck, that's a kilogram of gold, which is a lot of gold. If you look at the Ipswich talks, which are much thinner and have much smaller terminals, they are also a kilogram of gold. And if you look at the Snettisham Great Talk from a distance, it looks much bigger, much more gold. But what they've done is they've used all of these various techniques to kind of add space. So the hollow, the terminals are hollow, the neck ring is hollow and is made of all these springs, which obviously are hollow down the centre. So there is a real thing of more bang for your buck going on. And the absolute maximum of that is the tubular talks that you were talking about, which basically look like a an inner tube, I guess. And they are packed with wax and an iron core. But the amount of gold in that is only about 110 grams, which is the weight of a lemon. Compared to the Snettisham Great Talk, which is exactly the same size, but is 10 times that weight. So,
well, come back to the craftsmanship. Where geographically, though, have the finds been concentrated?
Well, the majority of talks from this country come from a site called Snettisham in East Anglia, which most people are very familiar with. And I think there's about 175 talks, the pieces of 175 talks from that site. Whereas for the rest of the UK, you're probably looking about less than 100 found in the whole of the rest of the UK.
That's amazing. Wow. What about Europe as a whole, though?
Europe as a whole, we like talks more than the rest of Europe. I think the last count that I saw for Europe is something like 350. It's all slightly changing because Snettisham hasn't yet been published and it keeps being reevaluated slightly as to how many there are there. But I think the overall total for the whole of Europe, including the UK, is only about 500 or so. This is just for the Iron Age, obviously. So we have a large proportion of them, and of that large proportion, most of those come from Snettisham. Snettisham is doing something odd. It's not typical.
I believe, though, that the first talk in this country was actually found in Scotland.
Netherard.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's our favourite. It's our absolute yes. Yes, we're very fond of Netherard. Little gold, it's a gold terminal from a talk that would have been basically the same as the
station. So the terminal is the decorated end?
The end, yeah. And all that survives of this talk is the terminal that was buried in the ground with three other twisted talks and some coins from that would have originated in France. Unfortunately, as they did back then, back in 1806, I think it was.
I know what you're going to say. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, they handed most of it to a goldsmith. So we have a couple of drawings. Luckily, the terminal survived. The talk terminal survived. And a couple of the coins were kept as well. But that terminal is something really, really special. It's beautifully made. It really is. And because it's not attached to the neck ring, we can actually look inside it and see what's going on. So it's been critical for our studies.
Didn't you overturn the conventional wisdom of how they were actually made in the first place?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, these particular ones, which all started because of the Newark talk, which was another talk found by detectorists in 2005 in Nottinghamshire. And Roland and I were talking one day and he just happened to say, look, I don't think they're made the way people have said they were. So I kind of had no knowledge at all about how they were supposed to be made. Did my usual academic thing and went and did a literature search to see what the evidence was. And although there were a lot of people saying these are cast and they're cast onto the wires, I couldn't find any actual evidence backing that up. So we started, it was one of those things where you just suddenly think, is this what I think it is? Let's go and have a look. And we did. And then found Netherard, because as I say, the Newark talk is complete, so you can't see inside it. Whereas Netherard, of course, we can actually have a look into the inside, and that's where on everything. You know, I've got a bit of a reputation on Twitter for asking people to show me the insides and the backsides of things.
The backside,
Show us your backside, yes. Yeah. Because that's where all the evidence of making is, and that's how you tell how things are made. And, yeah, Roll got on the internet, found Netherard and said, oh, I've found there's this talk in Scotland. So, yes, we went off to the National Museum of Scotland and had a look, and that changed everything because when we had a look inside it, you could see very, very clearly it wasn't cast. It was actually made of sheet gold. And because of the similarities with the Great Talk, we could actually suggest that the Great Talk was also sheet work. So we asked the British Museum to X-ray it, and sure enough, that was sheet talk as well, sheet work as well.
Mm. Amazing, really. It reminds me of a similar thing with Bruce Bradley, the amazing American archaeologist, who said, it's amazing how so many academics can write papers on hunting when they've never even been out and shot a rabbit.
Yeah, and that's the thing I'm learning more and more now, because I come from quite a crafty, practical background. My dad was a carpenter and various other things, so...
I was just going to digress very, very slightly. Yeah. What about your great grandfather?
the cycling one.
Yes, him.
Talking about craftsmanship.
Yeah, this is why also gold is important to me, because my ancestry, my great grandfather was the last in a line of Huguenot goldsmiths and diamond setters that go back to 1720s Huguenot France. And that's the earliest we've got. I mean, they probably go back even further than that. But yes, my great granddad was the last in the line of the Brioux goldsmiths, as they were. And he helped set the Cullinan diamond in the crown and the scepter. So
amazing.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I do feel like I'm continuing the family line a little bit, yeah.
You have to say about his cycling, though.
Yeah, he was also a champion cyclist. And he held the world record for London to Brighton and back in something ridiculous like 6 hours, I think it was, on a tricycle often as well.
This is incredible, isn't it?
I know, it is. He was, yeah, it was such a shame. He died in his early 30s. I'd love to have spoken to him. Oh, he's someone who, all of my ancestry, I'd have just been presenting them with bits of gold and saying, what's this? How did they make it?
A small diversion, but an important one, I think. I'm glad we got an end to that.
It's amazing how a little thing, how little threads can feed through families.
Yeah, absolutely.
But aside from the talks, because obviously that's such a huge part of your work, isn't it, really? But how do you see that? I mean, obviously you've specialised in that because you have a particular fascination for it. But from a social and cultural point of view in prehistory, how do you see them actually fitting there? You must have some sort of sense of what they're about.
My feeling is they're communal, because you don't... On the continent, you find them in graves. Not very often, but you do find them in graves.
Okay.
In this country, you don't. So we have all the incredible graves of East Yorkshire, the chariot burials, which have massive high status goods, all sorts of other things. They never include talks. Now, it may well be to do with differences in burial practices, perhaps, but... And we're also seeing a longevity to a lot of the talks, that they are... Snettisham seems to be a one-off event in the first century BC, where they put all of these talks in the ground. Probably the work we're doing at the moment is suggesting that they go in all at very similar time.
So it's not not occurring as a hoard, necessarily.
No. This is... My feeling is this is some kind of deposition at once, which ends the culture of talks in this country. Yeah, this is something we're working on at the moment. But there do seem to be relationships between the hoards. Basically, you've got pieces of material in one hoard that appear to have been taken from another hoard to be used, but that the whole lot has gone in the ground at the same time. But there's definitely cross links between various of the hoards. So it's not that one hoard went in and then 20 years later, the next hoard went in. As I say, it's very early stages, but our feeling is this happened very, very quickly. And it almost marked the end of that culture, that the relevance of talks was no longer there for whatever reason. And the feeling of them being communally owned, or I don't know what the right word for it would be, is that we know that several of those talks are quite a few hundred years old before they go in the ground.
Okay.
So where have they been in that time? We're also working on something where we think that we're working with people who specialise in spring fatigue, would you believe? Spring fatigue. It's a metal thing. Basically what we think, there's certain evidence from one of the talks at Snettisham that would suggest it's been opened and closed regularly, so presumably been taken on and off regularly, but has then been rested for a significant amount of time, and then when it's reused again, it's broken. Because of this particular way that metal fatigue works. Now, if that's the case, it does suggest that these things have a changing usage over time, that maybe they were going onto statues, or they were going away into boxes. We're not sure at the moment. This is all kind of developing, but it's certainly not a straightforward picture of you put your talk on for a ceremony, you take it off, it's yours. It seems to be much more complicated than that.
Wow. Do you have a sense at all as to who would have worn it? I mean, you know, breaking it down, starting at, you know, top level, would women have worn them predominantly?
Well,
or men? Or is it a split? Do we know?
again, there's all of these things. I mean, we've got this record of Boudicca wearing this gold necklace. Now, how accurate the translation of that is and things like that, I can't really comment on. I don't think there's anything to suggest that women weren't wearing them. We've obviously got elements of matriarchal society in Iron Age Britain. Equally, they, as I say, the very, very good ones, like the Snettisham Great Talk, Netherard, probably Newark, they are prestige items. They are made by the best goldsmiths. They are very complicated. The gold is very pure at a time when gold was a rare commodity.
Yeah.
That, to me, even though we keep trying to get away from things of status and prestige, you can't help looking that way. Now, whether that's monetary, I don't know. So it could be different how we see prestige nowadays. It might have been religious prestige or family prestige or... I don't know is the answer. I think these things were definitely, they were definitely important. They definitely meant something. Gold at a time when you don't really have anything naturally shiny. You know, we're so surrounded by shiny things nowadays. We don't think about it. But back then...
That's a fair point.
But it is, yeah. I mean, you've got water and you've got the occasional mirrors back then and maybe a bit of glass. But shiny metal, and particularly with gold because of the quality of it, that something like the Great Talk, when it came out of the ground, wouldn't have been tarnished, wouldn't have been. And that's what it would have looked like back then. It would have been gold. It would have been bright. Whoever had would have seen it would have been awed by it in the same way that we are now. And clearly it wasn't something that everybody had. And the minute you have something that not everybody has, you start looking at status and prestige and things like that. But then again, if it was owned by a community, it could be a community prestige, you know, that this community was important because it had this talk.
Yeah.
Who knows? I don't know. Yeah. I don't think we've got the answers.
Clear something up for me, Tess. Alongside the great... Snettisham talk.
Yeah.
You've got the Snettisham grotesque talk and the Snettisham mini grotesque talk. What's that about?
Well, the grotesque talk, the poor grotesque talk, when it came out of the ground, it was known as the marriage talk because it's got a loop of talk going through holding the terminals together, and it was seen as maybe symbolic of some kind of joining, linking marriage. And then it seems to have picked up along the way this description of the grotesque talk, because it's not as, it's something called plastic art, which is this very high relief, very modernistic almost nowadays looking style. So it then became the grotesque talk. And then when we found, because the trouble is all these things, we have to give these things names because then you know what you're talking about. We actually call the mini grotesque Heinz 57. Because it's a position, it's a position 57 on Norwich Castle's museum board, and it was kind of a bit of everything, so it was Heinz 57. But in papers, we called it the mini grotesque because it has a similar style of art to the grotesque talk.
I'm so glad we cleared that up.
We also have the B52 as well, which is another. It means Roll and I know what we're talking about rather than saying 1991.387, comma, you know, museum accession codes are a nightmare.
Interesting, interesting. So outside of talks, tell us about, how do talks fit into the rest of your understanding of Iron Age Britain, particularly Iron Age? I know you go back further, but...
I'm not sure. I will be completely honest with you at the moment because gold seems to be so unique. What we're finding now is we're even finding it's worked in a completely different way to other metals. So it's not even worked in the same way as bronze is. We're also still ploughing through all of the talks. There's quite a few of them. We've seen quite a lot of them now, and we've got a pretty good understanding of most, but we haven't seen all of them. And as I said,
did we mention the number that we have in this country?
Terms of pieces, we're up to probably, with PAS fines and various other things, I would say it's probably about 100.
Okay.
Maybe less than that, 70 odd. In terms of complete ones, I guess 30, 40. But they're all slightly different techniques. At the moment, we're just looking at the Taurus talks, which are the ones with donut terminals, like the Snettisham Great talk. Yeah. But we're gradually kind of going out from there. As we're understanding those ones, we're then starting to look at other ones and see how they fit as well. But currently, we don't really have a chronology for any of them, because most of them are either antiquarian fines or they're detector fines, or even when they've been kind of excavated properly, you've got no other contextual information. You've just got talks in the ground.
Oh, I see. Oh, amazing.
I didn't
realise that. That is a problem, isn't it?
Gee. Yeah, it's very tricky. So, and previously, everything has been down to art historical criteria. So this period of Celtic art dates to this phase. This one is later because, but it's all a bit, we're not entirely happy with it. We don't think, and the technology seems to be giving clues to suggest that actually things aren't quite the way, again, with that people have assumed that they were before. Because so often in this country, we've found something different and then said, oh, that must have been imported from the continent. We couldn't do that kind of metalworking at that stage. Whereas we're finding that, yes, actually, we were quite capable of doing metalworking of that skill at that stage.
Yeah.
And it also tends to happen from north to south. So Netherard has always been assumed of being an import from East Anglia, because Scotland couldn't do this stuff.
Uh-huh.
In inverted commas.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Whereas we are seeing more and more, you've got certain types of very specific Scottish finds, like these what's called massive arm rings, and also ribbon talks that are actually occurring in Cambridgeshire, East Anglia. So there is obviously trade going from Scotland south. And we've always wondered whether the talks are a north and west phenomenon, because that's where the gold is.
Interesting.
So,
Am I right in thinking that the Vikings come along and complicate matters a bit?
Well, this is the Newark talk was found, as I say, near Newark, which is on a river crossing. It was found in quite unusual circumstances, because it was found on its own, which, although that's not unheard of, normally talks are found in groups of kind of three or four. What's also really unusual about the Newark talk is that it has this rather large cut in it, which was always assumed to be kind of plough damage, something like that. When we had a really close look at it, you can see that actually it's been done with a very sharp blade. The knife has gone in and then it's been opened. So you've got a kind of open cut. Where you see this most often is something called Viking nicking, where they do it on all kinds of things, ingots, jewellery, you name it. Initially, it's thought to test purity. So you put a nick in it to check, is it 100% gold, or is it something that's been gilded to look like gold? But there also seems to be a ritual element. So you have these bar ingots, which have got about 40, 50 nicks in it. It may be something to do with trading, that as you pass it on, you nick it and it's part of the process. But anyway, this talk has a nick in it. And then when we started looking, there's another talk from further north at a place called Caister. I'm hoping I'm saying it right.
In the right place for pronunciation.
We love it.
It's in northeast England, so in Lincolnshire. But this also has a nick in it. And then when we looked a little bit further north, there were two, again, these ones are actually more bracelet-sized talks, one of which appears to have a nick in it also. And when you look at where these were actually found, they follow the route of the Great Viking Army. So there's a possibility. We haven't had a look. We've obviously seen Newark very, very closely. Wow. And it's definitely not your standard kind of post-depositional damage on it. Yeah, we've seen the photos of the damage on the other two talks, but we've yet to go and see them, which will make a bit more sense. Yeah. But we are wondering whether there was originally a hoard with all of those talks in up towards York, somewhere around the York way. Yeah. And then as they've come down the ooze, they've been kind of depositing talks as they go. It wouldn't be unheard of. Yeah, it's interesting. It's really interesting. There's a lot of evidence. Matt Knight, Dot Boughton and Rachel Wilkinson have just produced a book called Past in the Past, which is talking about how in history and prehistory people were reusing old objects. I don't think there's a problem with that. And if I think the Vikings came across a hoard of gold, they wouldn't have said, oh, that's Iron Age, we can't play with it. So,
absolutely.
More research needed. But yeah, it's a really interesting idea. It's still very much an idea at the moment. But
thank you so much. I think that's opened a few eyes and minds to the possibilities and the depth that there is to go into.
It's just extraordinary that something so clearly important can, you know, that there can be such a small amount of information about them.
Yes.
One last last question around talks to just finish that off is that artifacts like this, you don't get a full impression of them unless you see them in the flesh.
Absolutely.
I mean, Rupert and I can speak to that first time we saw the bush barrow lozenge from Stonehenge environs. And so where would you direct people to look at a decent talk or two in a museum up and down the country?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Newark, the National Civil War Museum in Newark is fantastic. You can have a good look at the Newark talk there. And they've also got some wonderful 17th century stuff, which, of course, I wouldn't be interested in at all. But, yeah. No, Newark is well worth a visit. National Museum of Scotland, to go and find Netherard. And also they've got the wonderful Blair Drummond Stirling hoard, which is the four gold talks. They're beautiful. Yeah. And the British Museum, obviously, for Snettisham. And Clevedon Museum. I'm thinking of more now. Clevedon Museum as well.
Great. Yes. Oh, wow.
So, and your website, of course. There's some wonderful photographs on your own website.
I'll put a link.
Yes, the Big Book of Talks.
The Big Book of Talks. Yes, yes. And, of course, the other thing, linking up with what Roland does, that's the wonderful thing about replicas is that you can pick them up. You can hold them. You can feel the weight of what it would have been like. Roll actually made a replica of the Southwest Norfolk talk for Norwich Castle Museum.
Yeah.
And we took that to the Europa we had a couple of years ago in honour of Peter Wells up in Edinburgh. And everyone was putting it on because you can really feel what they feel like then. And they're bizarre because you don't... The first time you pick up a talk, you think it's going to be very still, very static. And actually, they're really springy.
Oh,
and it's quite frighteningly springy in that they want to bash the ends together the whole time. You spend your whole time trying not to kind of damage this incredibly precious artifact. So, yes, it's only if you get to hold them, you really get a sense. Yeah. And also the weight of gold as well. It's very difficult to comprehend because it's more dense than lead.
Yes.
So it's heavier than lead. Mm. So you pick up something like the Great Talk, it really is, you know, you've got it in your hands.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So talking of replica talks, we hear that there's a couple of lunatics making them out of chocolate. What's that about?
Maybe. Yes. This started off, again, this is linked to Newark. I think this is when we were trying to work out how we could get some money to make a replica of the Newark talk. And one of the ideas was we'll make chocolate talks and sell them in the gift shop. And that then led to, you can buy modelling putty on the internet that's food safe. And of course, working with a replica maker who has lots of things that it doesn't matter if I cover them with moulding putty. So Yeah, I started making artifacts out of chocolate. And there's only two rules. It has to be 100% edible, and there has to be no internal structures to it. So I can't kind of put chocolate over something metal to give it a scaffold, as it were.
It's utterly breathtaking what you are making out of chocolate. I couldn't believe it when I first saw them. I thought, how could you actually bring yourself to eat them apart from anything else?
No.
I think I'd force myself, but but even, I mean, for people who haven't seen them yet, you know, you've got copper axes, flint arrowheads, you know, worked flints, all that kind of stuff. But they look like the actual artifact. They don't look like chocolate at all. It's an extraordinary piece of work.
They have fooled a couple of people, actually, that have actually thought, particularly the socketed, there's an Armorican axe that I made that did fool a couple of people. I keep threatening various museums that they'll come back and find that their talk is now a chocolate talk rather than...
Yes, come back into the museum in the morning and it's just a puddle of chocolate.
Ah, no, you see, atmosphere-controlled cases, it would be fine.
Perfect.
It's about the one place you can get away with it.
It's an extraordinary thing to do. So, I mean, but do you do these on commission? Can people buy a chocolate
No, I've made a couple for friends because, obviously, although I'm very careful... If you start going into things commercially, you need clean kitchens, you need hygiene certificates, all of that sort of thing. And it, for me, it's always been about the challenge. So it's more about, can I actually do it? That's always been the thing. And quite often, if I've made one once or twice and perfected it, I won't really make it again. I mean, we have done workshops in the past, Roland and I, where he talks about replicas. Actually, it's quite good fun. He talks about replicas. I bring along a load of chocolate, and for the last hour or so, everyone sits around, has a glass of wine, and paints something. So, takes away their own hand axe or whatever.
Because is it the butler's brooch?
Oh, yes, Mrs. Getty's brooch, the butler's field brooch.
Is just, to look at that, you would not in a million years imagine that it was chocolate. It's just extraordinary.
No, that one was because Roll actually carved out of, it's an epoxy resin, and he carved, because he needs a base for casting something, so he quite often carves a model, which he can then mould from to then cast... you know, what would effectively be a complete accurate copy of something. So I borrowed the model from him and covered it in modelling putty and then filled it with chocolate. But yes, Mrs. Getty's brooch is a nice one. And there's a Viking antler comb as well that I did that was absolutely impossible.
Yeah.
But I did it. So,
Anyway, I'll do as much as I can to put links and stuff in the description below.
Fantastic. Well, do you know, I mean, apart from the fun side of that, one of the other things I wanted to ask you about, because as far as I'm concerned, it's actually the most important thing that any of us can do, really, and that's your work with kids. You do a lot of educating of kids, don't you? And I think, you know, if we can inspire children these days into, you know, any of these fields, then it's a wonderful thing. So, tell us about what you do there.
Well, I'm actually a leader for the Young Archaeologists Club because, like you say, I remember when I was, you know, when I first started when I was 12, there were an awful lot of archaeologists put up with my letters of me saying, I want to do this. How can I do this? And wrote me back these lovely letters saying, well, have you thought about this? Have you tried that? There was a lot of mentoring along my way. And it's nice to offer something back, particularly now. Because I was educated at UCL, I was on a full grant. You know, I came from a family where nobody had really gone to university before. Those opportunities aren't there for so many people now. And particularly with the kids, I love it because I also work in schools teaching them about prehistory. And we've got a fantastic museum in St Albans who has just been brilliant. And they will lend me their handling collection. And we'll help out in various events and things like that. So, but it is where the next generation is. If we don't work with the children and inspire them and make them realise, because so many children don't think it's for them. Yeah. That's why I particularly like working in schools, because you have children from all kinds of backgrounds who would never even think of archaeology. It's just not on their mental map. But you can really inspire them. Again, replicas, reenactment and things like that come into that as well. Because Roland does a lot of work doing Viking things and Saxon reenactment. And when the kids see somebody dressed up as a Saxon Huskarl or a Viking with all the gear and swords and shields and, you know, the pots for making things and all sorts of other stuff, it just fires their imagination. It's so important. Really is.
Fantastic, it's great. I hadn't realised, you know, the prehistory was on the curriculum. How long has that been?
Since 2014. It's been
I'm
6 years
way behind
now.
The times. That's fantastic.
So year 3 and 4, what are they, 8, 9? They do. They start doing prehistory and they love it. They're really good at it.
Cool. That's so nice, actually. That really is a thing, so that we can actually be bringing kids up not to imagine our ancestors as just still lumbering around wearing bear skins.
I mean, that's part of the reason, going back to the Prehistoric Society, that was why we developed the school resources blog that we've launched a few weeks ago, because so many teachers were saying, we don't know what we're doing with this. You know, we know the Victorians, we know the Saxons, we don't really know where we're going with prehistory. So that was a large impetus behind us creating these resources. Because it is more intangible, you know, it's much easier to say, this is a Saxon, this is a Victorian person, this is, you know, Tudors.
Absolutely. But having read, you know, a few of your communications and blog posts, can I say how brilliant you communicate to your audience?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, they're really, really readable, and you know, you keep a story going and keep the interest there, and you point out what's pertinent.
That's part of the reason why we wanted to start the Big Book of Talks, because we are peer review academic publishing. That sits underneath everything we're doing, so it has to be proven with evidence and peer review. But we also wanted a way for people who are outside of academia, who haven't got access to the journals, and also just something that was current. So if we, because like I say, we're working on so many different things, and that whole thing with the Viking Nick talks, there's not enough evidence there yet to do something heavily peer reviewed on it. But there's enough to just put it out there and say, this is an interesting idea. And then if somebody else comes up with something, they can see that we're thinking about it as well. So, yeah, it's and also images. It means we can use lots and lots of images, which is lovely. Particularly with something like artifacts, you need to have lots and lots of images.
You do.
And the current restrictions of journal publishing, I understand why, because it costs them. You know, it's working for the Prehistoric Society. I know that the journal is the biggest thing we do, and it does have a cost implication. So yes, it's, but the website has allowed us really just to write the way we want to write, I think, occasionally, which is good fun.
Tess, it's been an absolute delight talking to you this afternoon, as we had.
I have to ask you before we disappear, it almost seems like a stupid question to say what's next, because you already do so much just ongoing stuff, you know, that you're just keeping on producing stuff. But have you got any shifts of impetus in the foreseeable future, or
That's a tricky one. I mean, we tend to go where the research takes us. That's the beauty of being independent researchers, that you can... suddenly think, right, this is an avenue we want to explore. We've got a lot more talks we want to see. Because at the moment, we're still categorizing them. We're at the basic level, really. The grand theories are yet to come. So, yes, see more talks, do more. I think the angle that we'd like to develop a lot more, because we work with an incredible team of goldsmiths and silversmiths, very, very talented. And I think we'd like to have a bit more of a go of experimental stuff to see. Yeah. I use the word experimental, replication. It's not an experiment. These guys know what they're doing. There's no experiment about it. But just to see what we can produce, how quickly we can produce it, and just learn a bit more about the talks, really, I think.
Yeah.
That's a plan.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Fingers crossed.
Well,
Tess, just, thank you so much.
Indeed. Indeed. It's been a treat.
Thank you.
And and well, hopefully, you know, when when all the lockdown and everything else has passed and things get back to I won't say normality, because I'm not sure that any of us really want that.
Yeah.
But when we, you know, when we're back to our work being able to move forwards again, then we very much look forward to seeing you.
Yes,
at,
yeah.
At conferences
at
and the
next
the like.
Event. So, yes,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Fingers crossed, end of October, we should be having a lecture, but we shall see. We
shall see.
We may have to go online instead. So,
in the meantime, I'm sure our listeners will have really enjoyed this. You know, it's probably an avenue that not many people have pursued.
And to have chocolate
this
and gold,
little bit of an eye-opener.
Chocolate and gold.
Really, really nice. Yeah,
and teaching kids. It is good work that you do. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks ever so much, Tess.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thanks to you folks for listening too.
Yeah.
All right. Bye-bye.
Cheerio. Bye.
Bye.